Welcome to the Heathrow results for the 3 months to the 31st of March 2020. Throughout the call, all participants will be on listen-only mode, so there's no need to mute your own individual lines, and afterwards there'll be a question and answer session. Just to remind you, this conference is being recorded. I'll now hand the floor to John Holland-Kay, Chief Executive Officer. Please begin.
Well, hello and welcome to everyone who has dialed into our Quarter 1 2020 results presentation. I'm John Holland-Kay, the Chief Executive at Heathrow Airport. With me virtually are Javier Echave, our CFO, and Sally Ding, our Director of Treasury and Corporate Finance. And we will be aiming to seamlessly, through the power of technology, present as we normally would if we were all together in the room. I hope you're all keeping safe and well, and your families are too. Let me start today by giving you an overview of how this extraordinary year is playing out for Heathrow, how we are immediately responding to the COVID-19 outbreak, and a review of our financial position. And I'll ask Javier to take us through that, and then we will open out for some questions. So let me start with slide four, the initial overview. And it seems strange to be talking about our financial results for the year to date when so much focus is now on the new reality that we are in at the moment. But I think from a financial point of view, it is significant because the financial results and the cash generated in the first quarter is very significant and very helpful at this time. So the overall picture is that we served 14.6 million passengers in the quarter as a whole, but as we'll see shortly, that's a very skewed towards the front end of the quarter, and our overall passengers were down by 18%. Our EBITDA was still at 315 million overall, down 22% on the previous year. We have a strong liquidity position, and we are looking at this for the long term. Our strong liquidity position allows us to be confident about surviving this crisis and being able to plan ahead, but we still need to make some significant decisions this year to make sure we protect our business and support all of our stakeholders. So our strategic priorities are consistent resilience, better service, and lower cost. And the resilience and cost side are probably the most significant factors for us at the moment. And I'll talk a little bit later about the things we are doing there. We've always had a strong focus on health and safety, but more than ever, we need to have a common standard for health in aviation, which is not something that we have focused on particularly in most aviation markets outside of Asia. And that's something that we need fast action on. We need to have a much more flexible operating model. There are clearly a wide range of scenarios for how the market might develop, some of which have the market bouncing back very quickly, some of which involve a much slower recovery. And we, as a responsible management team, we need to plan to be able to flex our business according to changing levels of demand, and that's something we are working on at the moment. And then, of course, we need a regulatory model that is fit for purpose. Our regulatory model is really designed around relatively stable businesses with a limited amount of growth opportunity. And it is true that, as you know, Heathrow Airport is at its capacity for ATMs in normal circumstances. So the upside potential is very limited. But as we are seeing right now, the downside potential is unlimited. And our regulatory model is just not fit for purpose for dealing with that level of extremes. It is too asymmetric. And so we need to take a good hard look with the regulator at how we have a better balance of risk and reward in the future. So let me now move on to slide five. And this really tells the story of the last 3 months. And you'll see that we started the year very strongly, good growth on January last year, a little bit muted in February, but still overall pretty much in line with the previous year. And if you remember, this is when the first initial outbreak of COVID was happening, and it was starting to move outside of China. And then if you look at March, you'll see the very sudden collapse in flying worldwide as countries moved quickly to lock down their markets, close their borders, and people stopped flying. And all of that happened in the space of 5 weeks. And now for the last 3 weeks, we've been in a pretty stable pattern with only about 3% of our usual passenger numbers traveling through the airport. And those are primarily repatriation flights, so where we are bringing people from all over the world back to the UK who have been part of that great diaspora, but also helping overseas citizens who have found themselves in the UK to get back to their home markets. And it's an important service that we play. So keeping the airport open and operating safely has been a starting point for the work that we have been doing to help serve the UK. Now, if you move on to the next slide, we'll see some of the pillars of the work that we've been doing. First of all, keeping people safe. We can only stay open if it is safe for people to work at the airport and to travel through. So that's been our first thought. The second is around maximizing revenues. We have been working with airlines to consolidate their operations into Heathrow. So although there's very little flights now happening across Europe, most airlines have, particularly long-haul airlines, have consolidated their operations into Heathrow. And we think that'll place us well for the recovery. And although there are very few flights happening, I was told that last week a third of all European flights were coming into Heathrow. So that just shows how significant we continue to be, even in this very tiny market. So that stands us in good stead. The other thing that we've been doing is to make sure that we are maximizing the cargo flights that we have coming through the airport. And this is hugely important for maintaining supplies of pharmaceuticals and PPE coming into the UK. So we've seen our volume of cargo flights move from about 7 per week to almost 40. 7 per day to almost 40 per day. That is nowhere near the volume of cargo that we would normally have, but it is helping to provide a vital supply line into the UK. And then our last pillar is around our protection plan, our business protection plan. How do we make sure that in any circumstances for the market, Heathrow will be financially robust and be well set up to benefit from any recovery when it comes. So we will talk a little bit more about the actions we've taken very quickly in a little while. And what we're trying to do is to make sure we think about all of our major stakeholders, our colleagues and passengers, our airlines and supply chain, the community around us. We're a very large employer. 1 in 4 households in the local area rely on us for employment. And of course, there is a huge threat to people's livelihoods at the moment, and that's something that we need to be responsible about. And then, of course, our debt and equity investors, making sure that their investment is very solid. So we're trying to manage our business to meet the needs of all that range of stakeholders. So if you move on to slide 7, I'll just touch on some of the measures we've taken around the airport. And right at the beginning of this crisis, we worked closely with Public Health England, who are the health authority in the UK, to make sure that we were promoting their messaging. Initially, that was very much sanitization, sanitizing your hands, washing frequently, and you'll see that we have hand sanitizer across the airport. Anywhere that you might have touched a handrail or a button, you will find a sanitizer, and there are well over 500 sanitizer points now installed across the airport. Very quickly, that moved on to wider messaging around staying at home. There is health screening that takes place in the journey through Public Health England, but it's less visible than you'll see at some other airports. And in the later stages, we have moved into social distancing, making sure that we can keep passengers and colleagues separated from each other. We've put up Perspex screens around desks so that if someone is checking in, there's some separation between the passenger and the airport worker, the same within security. So we've moved quickly to put those in place. And we have allowed people to wear face masks at work, and I think that will increasingly become a normal thing to do as we go through this next phase of the crisis, building up to a point where the crisis is over and we have a vaccine. And that, again, is something that we'll normally see in Asian markets anyway. And I think one thing we have learned from this is that social distancing for passengers in an airport just will not work as a solution to getting people flying again. And if I can just give you an example of that, a jumbo jet with 450, 500 passengers on board would need a line a kilometre long, so between half a mile and a mile, in order to allow people to queue. And if you think about the passenger journey for departing passengers, when you have to go through check-in, bag drop, security, and then go into the gate, it is physically impossible to maintain any volume of passengers in any airport in the world if you have to socially distance. So I'll come on later to talking about what the alternatives will be to social distancing in airports. And you will know that this isn't just an issue for airports, it's an issue for any kind of transportation and many other economic sectors. So we're trying to stay ahead here and make sure that Heathrow is the safest airport to travel through. So can we move on to the next slide, slide 8? You'll be familiar with the layout of the slide. Normally we talk about the markets and how they are growing. That's not particularly relevant at this time. But there's a couple of things I did want to pick out of the usual numbers we share. The first is around cargo, where you'll see that looking at just the quarter one figures, already you can start to see the growth in cargo-only air traffic movements in that period up to the end of March, and that, of course, has continued going through to April, while the number of passenger air traffic movements have reduced. Now, from a financial point of view, we make very little revenue from cargo movements. It's generally a very low-margin business globally. So this does not compensate in any material way for the significant decline in passengers. And in fact, to be able to manage the amount of cargo that we normally have, that relies upon passenger planes traveling from Heathrow. So until we get those passenger planes back up and running, particularly the long-haul flights, we won't see a significant growth in cargo volumes either. And that is fundamental to the UK and global supply chain to get imports and exports in and out. The other thing I'd just highlight here is the passenger traffic at European hubs. And normally I'd make a point about how Heathrow is being held back from growing because other hubs have plenty of capacity and Heathrow doesn't. What you'll see here is that over that three-month period, actually Heathrow has been the most resilient of hub airports, even though in places like France, Charles de Gaulle has had the benefit of being able to close all the airports and move all of its flights into Heathrow. We don't have that coordinated system in the UK, but in spite of that, Heathrow has had the least decline over that period. Now, we're in this world, we're all in a reasonably similar position, but I think this is an indication that Heathrow is the last airport you choose to leave and will be the first airport that airlines choose to come back to. And even if some airlines reduce their flying from Heathrow, and you'll have seen speculation about some of our larger carriers reducing the size of their fleet over the last few days. Even if that is to happen, I think that we will see other airlines who have not been able to come into Heathrow historically because of lack of slots would quickly come in to take up the slack that is left there. And that is something that is, I think, unique to Heathrow among certainly UK airports and largely international airports as well. So if we can move on now to the next slide, I'll just give an overview of the protection plan, and Javier will go into this in a bit more detail. And as the number of passengers has reduced, we've moved quickly to consolidate our operations down to two terminals and one runway, and that has allowed us to reduce the number of colleagues we have working and to move as many as possible onto the government furlough scheme, which is designed to protect jobs in businesses like ours, where demand has completely disappeared. So as at the time of speaking, we have about 3,000 colleagues who are furloughed, which is almost half of our total population. We are just completing the consolidation of Terminal 4 and operations moved out of Terminal 3 last week, so we're getting on with that. And that is a very significant movement of airlines, because although there are very few flights going, we have quite a lot of airlines that are still operating, and we have to move their entire operations from one terminal to another. That's a process that normally takes 18 months to 2 years, and we've done it in 2 to 3 weeks. So it's a really good example of how quickly we are moving, working closely with our airline customers. We have reorganized our business. We have a plan to take about 30% of our costs out for the balance of this year. Some of this is temporary and some of it is permanent, and Javier will describe some of that. We have reduced our capital expenditure to conserve cash, and we've reduced it by about $600 million over the course of this year. And there will still be some investment that we make, but it will be at a very small level to make sure we're completing projects, doing essential maintenance, and in some cases doing work that would not normally be possible in daylight hours, because we have the benefit of having a runway closed at any point in time. We have a good liquidity position, but we can't take that for granted. We need to work hard to conserve our cash. Our normal cash burn rate would be about £200 million a month with this very low level of revenue. So we have to work hard to get that down, and that will help to protect us for longer. I've touched on regulation. It is not fit for purpose as it stands. And we will work with the regulator and our airlines to come up with something that works better. Clearly, we understand that in a world where there's very little demand and where there's the airlines are suffering as well, now is not the time to be putting prices up. But there does need to be a fair balance of risk and reward in the future to make sure that investors can invest in confidence in the business, that they will get a fair return in any circumstances. And then finally, we are supporting our ecosystem. We have to work closely with our retailers and airlines to make sure that they come through this effectively, successfully. We have taken measures such as not charging for parking over the last couple of months for planes that have been parked up. That particularly benefits our home carriers. We have been working with them to make sure that we can keep their people safe. We've also supported the airlines in the suspension of the 80-20 rule in the early months of this crisis to make sure they're not flying planes that are uneconomic and mostly empty. So we are working closely together at a time when all companies are facing quite a lot of financial stress. So let us move on from there to slide 10. And at this point, I will hand over to Javier, who will take us through the financial overview.
Great. Thank you, John. And welcome everyone who is joining us today. And foremost, first of all, is I hope that everyone is keeping safe and well. So I will give you an overview of our key financial indicators, starting from slide 11. As John has alluded, our financial performance was clearly affected by the reduced number of passengers traveling through Heathrow. Going component by component, revenue declined by 12.7% in comparison with 2019. And you can see that aeronautical and retail revenue suffer from the rapid deterioration in traffic, especially from March, when the impact of the virus became even more apparent. And as you have also seen in previous slides, that materially worsened in the month of April. Operating costs overall increased by 1.8%, and that reflects the investments in service that we made early in the year before the outbreak. So the early increase in operating costs was somewhat offset by the savings already secure through management initiatives that we have put in place. Altogether, this means that adjusted EBITDA in the three-month period to March declined by 22.4% to £315 million. Talking briefly below EBITDA, it is worth noting that we booked in the period an exceptional loss of £82 million. and that includes £30 million related to our restructuring program and reflects the one-off cost of exiting around 500 members of our senior team. The exceptional charge also reflects £52 million of non-cash write-off of previously capitalized costs in the period, as some of the projects were either put on hold or were unlikely to resume in the short term as a result of COVID-19. So that adds to the £82 million. Additionally, we reflect in our accounts the non-cash fair value movement of our investment properties that also deteriorated by £184 million, and that was primarily driven by loss of trade in our car parks. So that explains why we have moved from a positive EBITDA to a negative operating loss. Moving into capital expenditure in the period, it did increase by 17.3% to 224, and that includes £63 million of expansion that was mostly incurred before the Court of Appeals ruling in late February. We expect the CapEx run to decline significantly and rapidly for the balance of the year at around £20 million per month, or £220 million in total, and the investment in expansion for the remainder of 2020 will be minimal. Turning into debt metrics, we continue to have appropriate headroom to leverage and trigger events and covenants at all levels of the capital structure, and as John mentioned, we benefit from a strong liquidity position with £2.5 billion of cash held at Heathrow SP, and a total of £3.2 billion of cash and committed facilities across the wider Heathrow Group. So let me now take a closer look to the details, starting with revenue on slide 12. So overall, revenue fell by 12.7%, and aeronautical revenue specifically went down 16.2%, driven by, obviously, a rapid deterioration in passenger numbers and fewer aircraft movements, especially following the European Commission's temporary suspension of the slot usage rule during the period. Until that suspension, we saw fewer flights, but not materially fewer, but with lower load factors in order to maintain their slots. Average aeronautical revenue per passenger increased in comparison to 2019 as airlines benefited last year from a rebate through our commercial airline deal. This rebate related with the commercial airline deal is not likely to be paid in 2020 as the deal assumes certain thresholds that now we expect that will not be met, and therefore the rebate will not become payable. Moving to retail revenue declined by 15%, again, driven predominantly by reduced passenger numbers. When looking at on a per-passenger basis, we did have a higher retail income per passenger because we enjoy from the minimum value guarantees providing a bottom threshold whilst passenger ramp numbers decline. Finally, other revenues increased by 3.6% as we collected annualized benefits from track access charges for the first time. And I think in terms of giving you some sense in terms of what we see in the months to come, and if we look at March in isolation, when the effect of COVID-19 became more visible, total revenue in the month of March declined by 28.9%. And this reflects not only the impact of further deterioration of passenger numbers, as John mentioned in previous slides, but also the fact that a majority of outlets, retail outlets in the terminals, closed from the last week of the month. Moving on to costs on slide 13, our costs increased by 1.8% in the 3-month period, reflected, as mentioned, the investment made early in the year. Obviously, just a reminder, those investments, similar to what we did back in 2009 in December 2019, included services for passengers with reduced mobility, implementing new whole baggage screening, and a rise in government levies associated with our utility costs that largely drove the 25% uptick that you can see in other costs on the top chart. Given the significant impact expected on Heathrow's performance this year, we have taken immediate action to reduce our cost base by at least £300 million or 30% for the remainder of this year 2020, with a very clear focus of preserving our cash position and financial resilience. So if I give you a bit more color in terms of what's behind those £300 million, our actions has focusing primarily on four areas. First of all is people. People represent a third of our cost base, and we have taken significant action to such as cancelling executive pay. So John, this will be his second month that he's not taking pay. I am just joining back a paid employment market, a company-wide paid reduction and bonus cancellation, freezing recruitment and restructuring our organization, primarily starting with our senior management, where the restructuring has involved a third of our senior team leaving the business on a permanent basis. We're also taking advantage of the government furlough scheme to protect jobs, and so far we have around 3,000 colleagues that have joined the scheme. For those who live in the UK, you know that the scheme currently lasts until the end of June. That's people. The second key area of intervention has been around consolidating our operations into a smaller footprint, and John has already described that we are currently operating from two terminals, Terminal 2 and Terminal 5, as well as on a single runway. That's allowing us to reduce facilities and maintenance costs, but also it's allowing us to gain operational resilience by operating with a single runway. And finally, the two other areas of intervention is we are renegotiating all our supplier contracts, more than 300 contracts. We are looking with our team Hydro. And importantly, we have stopped all non-essential costs until further costs. So those are the four key areas that we have focused our intervention, and we believe that that will deliver at least £300 million for 2020. These initiatives have started to materialize, and in the month of March in isolation, we have seen costs coming down by 5.4%. In the meantime, obviously, as our cost base is largely a fixed cost, it tends to reduce slower than our passenger numbers, and that explains why you see a rise in cost per passenger while we reach a full run rate of savings of the initiatives that I just described. Moving on cash flows on page 14, obviously our cash flows were impacted by the loss in passenger numbers and revenue, down 12% compared to 2019. However, we have maintained a strong discipline in managing our working capital with limited net changes, and we were still in a position to cover our reduced cash capital expenditure bill and interest payments. Dividends. We did pay £100 million of dividends to ultimate shareholders in the early weeks of the year, reflecting the strong cumulative outperformance of the business until the end of January. But obviously, that payment was approved before the significant impacts of COVID-19 became evident. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done so. And when you add all the cash flows in combination, you can see that the net debt increased by just £60 million over the three-month period. Turning to slide 15, obviously cash and liquidity is absolutely paramount in this time of crisis. And I think that we are in a very good situation. John mentioned that we have strong liquidity amounting to a total of £3.2 billion at the end of March. And that itself reflects something that hopefully all of you investors are familiar, the way we manage finances at Hydro, which is prudently. Our liquidity policy is designed precisely for downside, and is designed to ensure that we have at least 12-month liquidity horizon at any point in time, even in the most extreme stress test scenario of zero revenues. In simple terms, that means that under conservative assumptions on our revenue and cost initiatives for the rest of the year, we are able to cover all our outflows until at least 12 months. That includes forecast operating costs, capital expenditure, debt service, as well as debt principal repayments. So hopefully you will agree that that puts us in a strong position, but also calls for additional controls, which we have implemented earlier, simply by the size of and the amount of cash that we are managing these days. So these controls include, for instance, enhanced payment monitoring across 80 airlines, 100 retailers and 200 tenants, as well as monitoring for risk of partner failures and supply chain. And this is where you can see the engagement, the strong engagement that we have with our team Hydro. The fact that we have committed as an organization to prompt payment codes. Now we are seeing that our airline partners, retail partners, and tenant partners, they are corresponding that behavior. And so far, we haven't seen a material deterioration of bad debt. The controls also include enhanced monitoring and further diversification of our bank counterparties with whom we have deposited larger amounts of cash. And in addition to these measures, our ongoing dialogue with credit rating agencies continue to ensure visibility and transparency on our situation and financial position. Turning to slide 16, our balance sheet remains robust and we continue to monitor carefully our headroom to all ratios. Obviously, whilst we never could have anticipated this situation, the fact that we have been taking critical and prudent steps over the past decade to beef up our financial resilience is paying back now in times of crisis. So we currently have appropriate headroom to gearing trigger events as well as covenants at all the three levels of our capital structure. And obviously, with a decline in traffic, we will see a reduced headroom, especially on our interest cover ratio due to the impact of this crisis on our cash flows. Moving to slide 17, you can see the principal strategic, corporate, and operational risks that we are facing at this point. Back in February, we shared with you our 2019 annual report and accounts, and we disclose all the principal risks that Hydro faces and that we, management team, are proactively managing every day. This is obviously the biggest crisis that we have faced in decades, and that has put virtually every single risk in a higher position. So obviously, we keep monitoring our risk because understanding and managing this risk is absolutely essential to secure that we navigate this crisis successfully. Finally, and moving on to slide 18 to conclude the financial section, let me give you some sense in terms of outlook. So obviously, given the heightened uncertainty, traffic and financial forecasts are inherently subjective at this stage more than before. And we are currently working hard to provide a revised management business plan, as the numbers we released in our last investor report in December did not reflect, obviously, the impact of COVID-19. So currently we are working on that forecast, and a revised guidance will be provided to markets in our June investor report, which we are now targeting to publish earlier than before and will be published now in the first half of June. So I will now close financial review and hand back to John for provide a wrap-up and a strategic update. Thank you.
John, if your line is muted, you will need to unmute.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Javier, and I hope that you will see that we have moved quickly to protect the business, taking swift action around costs and putting tight cash management controls in place and recalibrating what we do. But we need to look forward to where we go next, because we cannot cost cut our way out of this crisis. We need passengers to come back. And there are a wide range of scenarios, and I'm sure that you have studied those, some of which see aviation coming back very soon, some see a much longer process. I think that if we were to be here in 10 or 15 years' time, we'd see that demand had recovered very well. But right now, quite how we get there is very hard to say. So what do I think are the things that need to happen before we get flying moving again? Well, the first, obviously, is that we need to get the health crisis under control. We need countries to reduce the level of infection rate very substantially. And the first thing that will happen as that infection rate comes down is that the lockdowns will be lifted and people will be able to go about their normal business. Now, once several countries have got down to a similar and low level of infection, and this may be a month or two away, we can start to think about reopening borders and getting people flying again. But of course, any country will be very cautious about the risk of reinfection when they've taken such drastic measures to protect themselves. So they will only do so with other countries that they feel have similar standards and will want to have good controls about the safety of people who are coming into their country. And this is where we need to make sure we've got a common international standard for helping people to fly internationally. And what we've seen when we went into this crisis is that each country reacted very quickly, coming up with its own set of measures, which are very different from country to country. But we need to do better coming out of this crisis so we have some commonality and some recognition of one another's standards. Now, this shouldn't be too complicated. We've gone through exactly the same thing with security standards. If you think about the big changes that came in 2006 with the ban on laptops and liquids, and we have completely changed the way in which aviation works to accommodate that. I think actually the change for making aviation safe from a health point of view will be much simpler than that. And we can look to the kind of measures that are already in place in Asian markets as a good example for the kind of things we will need to do. And so what I anticipate there will be some form of health screening, which might be thermal imaging to help filter out people who are unlikely, who have a higher risk of currently having the disease, for further tests while other people can go on their way. And that will allow the vast, vast majority of people to fly. I think it will become normal for people to wear surgical masks when they are traveling. Again, something you see very commonly with people from Asian countries. And of course, we'll have very good sanitization standards across the airport, plenty of hand sanitizer, but also increasingly moving away from people needing to touch buttons and things like that to reduce the risk of infection, and measures to reduce the amount of close proximity between airport workers and passengers. So screens at check-in, we have already started putting in place the same at security. And increasingly, I think, a move towards more automation of the passenger journey to take out the need for direct contact. And I think it's those, that kind of package of measures, building on the example of what we already see in Asia that was brought in response to the SARS crisis, which will help to build confidence in countries to open their borders again and get people flying. And exactly when that happens, we don't know. That will have to be driven by the reduction in infection rate. But we need to start planning for that now. And that's why we are calling on the UK and other governments to start working on these common international standards, and why we're working closely with airlines and other airports to try to identify what those should be. Now, from a demand point of view, there's clearly a lot of speculation about whether people will still want to fly. If you look at the forward booking data, you'll see there is massive demand to fly. And of course, this is one thing where history tells us something, that even after 9/11, the demand for flying bounced back very quickly. Now, clearly, people have to feel safe to go and visit another country, but there is clearly a built-up demand for flying. And that bodes well, I think, for the future. Obviously, we will change some of the things we do. I'm sure we will spend more time on video calls and maybe less time in the office. We may do some less traveling. But there are many things that you can only do face-to-face. The range, the great benefit of Heathrow is the versatility of our business model, with that combination of inbound tourism as well as outbound, students, investors, business people, exporters, cargo. We have such a rich and diverse international passenger base that we are very well placed to benefit from this. And I think we will tend to see a retrenchment of aviation towards hub airports, where over the last decade or so, there's been an increasing development of long-haul point-to-point in particular. And we may be starting to see that already with some of the steps that are being taken by airlines. But the key thing to start with is to get that common health standard in place and the measures that support it implemented as fast as possible. So we're working hard on that. We're working hard to get our costs down as low as possible. We need to make sure that when we're staying open, we're doing it in the most cost-effective way that we can and get our costs as the staying open as close as possible to the costs of being closed. And that will make sure we conserve cash as much as we can. We need to start thinking ahead for any changes in the dynamics of the future aviation market. Cargo is clearly an important opportunity for us in the very short term. It's not a huge value driver, but clearly aviation has a fantastic role to play in getting the UK and other economies up and running. And the sooner we can get passenger flights going again, the sooner we can get the supply chains, which are based on cargo, belly hold passenger flights, up and running quickly. And I've talked about some of the measures we want to take to make sure that Heathrow is the safest airport to travel through. And then, of course, the final point is our ESG agenda. We have been for the last year or so one of the leaders in calling for net zero carbon in aviation. We pioneered a very ambitious sustainability plan aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals with Heathrow 2.0, which touches on all the wide range of sustainability measures. I think one lesson we should all take from the pandemic is that we did have some early warning signs of this, including the kind of lessons from the SARS crisis in Asia. And the countries that responded to that and got contingency plans in place have performed better through this than those that did not. We need to make sure we don't miss the early warning signs of climate change because that is a crisis that we may not be able to recover from. So we need to build back better as we come out of the crisis, accelerate the move towards zero carbon aviation. And one thing we are calling on is that any aviation businesses, as with other carbon intensive sectors that are supported by government funding, should make commitments around decarbonizing their operations. And I think that is something that will help to accelerate the move towards net zero carbon by 2050. So let me close the call there in terms of the presentation, but I will ask Mark to just open up the lines for Q&A.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please dial 01 on your telephone keypad now to enter the queue. Once your name is announced, you can ask your question. If you find it's answered before it's your turn to speak, you can dial 02 to cancel. So once again, that's 01 to ask a question or 02 if you need to cancel. There'll be a brief pause now whilst you register your questions. Our first question comes from the line of Alex Devinson from Schroders. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I just had a couple of questions. One, just confirming the 30% cost reduction. That's total costs, including all the staff being furloughed, et cetera, because I understand you've got a high fixed cost base, but the staff, which is essentially fixed, I mean, I guess the majority, you said 3,000 are now furloughed, so that's a majority of fixed cost, a third of your total cost now essentially being variable. And then looking at your other costs, sort of the maintenance and operational costs constitute, I think, around half of your total cost. And I imagine when the 97% traffic reduction, that can be significantly reduced. So I'm just wondering, you know, could you, if possible, could you go lower than 30 if it's a sort of prolonged, restricted period? Or is 30 really the sort of max you can go, including all the staff being furloughed and even if the sort of airport remains, you know, as it is now for the next sort of 3 to 4 months?
Yeah. Great. Did you have a second question?
Yeah, and then the second question, you didn't really mention anything on shareholders and dividends. You noticed that there was a dividend paid in Q1. I imagine that was done pre-COVID. I was just wondering, given Chancellor Sunak said very early on in the crisis that the airports and airlines weren't going to get us any support until they looked at other areas. Given the amount of dividends that Heathrow has been paid out, paying out in the last few years, I imagine that, I guess, the Chancellor was probably expecting some shareholder support before government support. So just wondering if you could give an update on any potential shareholder conversations you've been having, or, and on top of that, any government conversations you're having in terms
sure.
of support.
Good. Thank you, Alex. So in terms of the cost reduction, some of those are temporary, such as the furlough that you mentioned. Some of those are permanent. And we're going through the next wave of cost review to see what we can take out in terms of structural costs from the business. So what we're trying to judge is to what extent we can improve efficiency within the business, and to what extent further cost reductions would reduce our capacity to be able to bounce back. And of course, you've got to be very careful with that, because in such an operationally leveraged business with a structurally high fixed cost base, if you can't benefit from any growth in revenue, it can disproportionately it can leave you with a big opportunity cost to not being able to grow again on the uptick. So we're looking at that closely, and we may be able to give you more of an update on that when we do our investor report in June. In terms of dividends and shareholder support, there clearly won't be any dividends being paid until the business is back in good financial health. The demand is back. We're back in making profits again. Shareholders have been very supportive. All of the cash burn that we incur at the moment is effectively coming out of shareholder funds. They've always been very committed to the business, as you know, and will continue to be. But we haven't had any conversations with the government. We don't envisage needing government funding. We have been encouraging the government to take steps to support the overall aviation sector. We support any company-specific deals to keep the UK airlines flying, and also sector deals. And specifically, we are looking for reductions, either waivers or deferrals, for some of the very high government costs that we incur, such as business rates and policing costs, where we've had more success so far in negotiating reductions with the rest of our supply chain, but not yet with the government. And I think that's an area of opportunity. And that kind of thing would count as would be a good example of the kind of cost reductions we might be able to enjoy this year when we need them most, which may not reoccur next year. Alex, I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's great. I just had a third, which I forgot to ask. You mentioned
okay.
the 200 million normal burn rate per month. Could you please describe what exactly in that 200 million, is that just a P&L cash burn, or does that include your debt servicing costs and CapEx? Just because you threw that number out, it'd be good to know roughly what
yeah.
is in that sort of in normal conditions. And if you can, if you could describe roughly what it is now or what you envisage after the sort of 30% cost reduction, what your sort of monthly cash burn would be going forward. Thanks.
Yeah,
I can help you with it. Yes. So I think, Alex, I think if you take a broad average of the burn cost in 2019, actually that totaled to £200 million. But actually, during December and January, it increased to £250 million per month. So that, on average, was roughly £100 million of OPEX, £100 million of CAPEX, and £50 million of interest payments. So that's obviously before any repayment of principal debt. So that total to around £250 million. What we have done through our rapid and drastic management action is to reduce that £250 to £150. And effectively, the way that we have done that is by reducing our costs by 30% from £100 to £70. drastically reducing our capital investment from around 100 to just 20 per month. And obviously, interest payments are fixed at 50. So that gives you some color of 150 million pounds per month. So obviously, time is essence, because just doing quick maths, in January we were burning around 8 million pounds a month a day. Today we are burning around 5 million pounds a day, which is a significant reduction. It's putting us in good situation, but obviously we continue monitoring and exploring opportunities to reduce that further, while ensuring that we are fit for purpose to ramp back up as quickly as possible. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, that's great. Many thanks.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Javier. Do we have another question?
Yep. Our next question comes from the line of James Sparrow at BNP Paribas. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi, afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the call. I hope everyone's well. I've just got two questions. The first one is regarding liquidity at Heathrow Finance. Just wondered if you could break that down. If you could talk about if the sort of interest cover covenant kicks in and stops you from being able to pay a dividend up to Heathrow Finance, how effectively that can fund itself. And then the second question is, you touched earlier on sort of, you know, potential longer term sort of structural changes to air travel. Just curious to think if you, at this stage you can comment at all on expansion or whether it's really just too early days to talk about that. Thanks.
Great. Well, let me take the second of those first, and then Sally, if you want to cover the Heathrow Finance liquidity question. So in terms of structural changes and particularly around expansion, it's really not something that I've given a lot of thought to over the last few weeks, as you'd understand. But we are, as you'll have seen, continuing to pursue the judicial review to the Supreme Court. I think we have a good chance of being successful there. And the real question is demand going to come back to a level which would support the need for a third runway? I think that in 10 or 15 years' time, if the UK economy recovers, then we absolutely will need that. And so the couple of years delay to the expansion program caused by the Supreme Court appeal won't make a material difference in terms of having that capacity available to meet the demand. The key question will be whether the business case works from an investor point of view, given that it'll be a significant investment in the airport at a time when there's much more uncertainty about demand. And of course, that's something that we will have to review over the next couple of years in the context of both the market and the kind of regulatory environment we have. But if you ask me, do I think there's a need for a third runway? Absolutely, there will be. Now, in terms of Heathrow Finance liquidity, of course, I'd like to answer that question myself in detail, but Sally will be far better at doing it.
I can take that, John. So thank you, James. I think it's a great question. So we talked about the overall liquidity of the group, 3.2 billion pounds. But obviously, one of the areas that we have been very clear is that we have the right liquidity buffers across the group. So at the end of March, we had around 250 million pounds in Heathrow Finance. We expect that liquidity to build. We have a couple of facilities that we can draw during the months of May and June, and therefore we expect that liquidity to grow to 450 million pounds. Obviously, when you look at the refinancing and the liquidity profile of Heathrow Finance, we have no debt principal schedules until 2024, which means that the liquidity in Heathrow Finance also is in a strong situation, and roughly our debt service burn rate on an annual basis is around 100 million pounds. So as you can see, we today 250 expected to grow to around 450 the next few weeks, and no maturities until 2024. So overall, in a strong position.
That's very clear. Thank you.
Thanks, Abby.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of James Renault of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, James.
Hi there. Thank you all for the update. One question for me. It's just on, you mentioned the narrowing headroom to the ICR covenants. If these come in under pressure, you know, understanding is quite hard to remedy, you know, on say the permitted equity cure in the docs. DCVs and debt as such is, you know, doesn't really solve an interest coverage question. And you know that is implications not just for dividends, which have been mentioned, up more to the holdco businesses, but for refinancing as well. If you know, it becomes an event of default under the documentation. You know, if we were to get into a situation where, you know, we breach the ICR covenants, you know, how do you envisage remedying this? You know, should we be looking at a consent solicitation? Yeah, just wondering what those offers are like.
Great. Good question. Javi, do you want to pick that up?
Yes. So I think as mentioned, currently we don't expect to breach any trigger or covenant, neither in HydroSP nor Hydro Finance. But obviously, given the recent deterioration in traffic, we're indeed seeing a reduced headroom in our ICR at Hydro Finance. So I said at this stage, we are not expecting a breach there, but we will continue monitoring and exploring potential remedies if that headroom were becoming too tight. And obviously, as part of our June investor report, we will share with you and give you further update in terms of forecast.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Philip Small at Cairns Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. Good afternoon. A couple of things on the common standard. First, is there any kind of timeline for when this is likely to be agreed? And then is there a cost implication if we've got to have like temperature scanners installed across the terminals? And any other kind of requirements. And then the other thing was just in terms of social distancing, is there any impact on kind of OPEX and operational, just ongoing kind of cost of that? Thanks.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the second part of the question around the costs. Can you just review that, please?
It was just in terms of whether social distancing measures you've put in place
have an
ongoing impact on operational costs.
Good. Thank you. Yes. So in terms of the common international standard, we started working on this. The Department of Transport has got a team working on it, but we've been speaking with the European Commission for a couple of weeks now. And in fact, yesterday I chaired a call with some of the other big global hub airports who are in a similar position to us to see if an alternative to having an intergovernment agreement would be to set up effectively air bridges between some of the big hubs to get trading links moving again. So there's a lot happening on this at the moment. There is no one clear organizing body, but I think that for an airport like Heathrow, if we get alignment between the UK, the EU, and the US, then that would be a very strong starting point for establishing a global standard. And I think a lot of the work needs to happen on that in the next month or two to allow us to be ready to get going. Now, in the meantime, we are working on what those standards could look like. We are doing testing on some of the equipment. And in fact, I went to look at a test just now. And the logistically, this is not particularly burdensome to implement, and I think that's one of the key factors that that we need to take into account. So it should be a much simpler process to implement than the complete change in airport design that happened with the laptops and liquids change in 2006. So I don't think the cost will be a material factor. In terms of social distancing measures, at the moment the cost of that is not particularly material. I think that but equally our passenger numbers are not particularly significant at the moment, and as I mentioned, I don't think it is feasible to manage social distancing at any large scale in airports. And if that did become required, then that would involve an entire redesign of the entire airport process, which would be material. I don't think that will be necessary because I think there is a better alternative to social distancing along the lines that I've described.
If I can ask just one thing, John, I think it's important to remember that obviously as a regulated business, obviously this unprecedented crisis is always terrible. That if you have to pick a point in time to face this type of crisis as a regulated business, probably we couldn't have been more lucky because obviously we have 18 months to go to complete this regulatory settlement, and obviously the potential changes that could come in measures of common international standards going forward will be included and re-baselining our cost base from the start of 8.7 from 2022.
Yeah, good point. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Josaria Blazar of Insight Investment. Please go ahead, your line is open.
Good afternoon. This is Charles-Henri Boivin from Insight Investment. I have a couple of questions. First on retail. First of all, currently, how is the situation? So are tenants still paying like a minimum rent, or is it kind of, you know, discussions to be postponed? And also, if you can share a bit of color on the process to when demand is back to reopen the retail. Is it gradual after aeronautical passengers and traffic come back, or is it a straight restart, food versus non-food, et cetera? And just the last question on CapEx, just your 500 million guidance for the year, the maintenance share versus the expansion breakdown. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Well, if I take the first half and then have you, perhaps you can pick up the CapEx question. So in terms of commercial operations, any retail activity now is absolutely minimal. So I was in Terminal 2 yesterday. The WH Smiths is, I think, the only shop that is open, and it's effectively operating as a one-size-fits-all retailer with food and food and drinks and essentials for travel. But everything else is closed. And Terminal 2 is our busiest terminal just at the moment. And I think that will continue over the next few months. We are working closely with retailers. Some of them have, you'll know that a minimum guarantee level is normal. Some of those minimum guarantees are based on a per passenger basis. Some of them are more fixed. And so the situation is complex. And we will work with the retailers to make sure that we have a fair balance. So I probably can't say any more than that would be useful to you in trying to put any kind of financial forecast together. In terms of restart, I would think that it would all start together. And what is normal with the way that we operate, so if you take, for example, when we opened Terminal 2, even though the passenger numbers were very low, we had every single shop and restaurant open on day one so that we can serve our passengers as best we can, operating full hours. And I would expect that it will be something like that. But clearly there are different market scenarios that could occur, and if this situation goes on for significantly longer, we may have to make some different choices. But that would certainly be my expectation at the moment. We've only had a couple of retailers in financial distress at the moment that aren't so far material to our overall revenues, so we don't have any significant voids. But of course, that can change because retail generally has been significantly affected. So we'll keep a close eye on these, and we may be able to tell you a little bit more at the market update in June. But Javi, do you want to pick up the CapEx question?
Yeah, thank you. So obviously, the total of CapEx that we're expecting for the whole 2020 would be around no more than £500 million. But when you look at the actuals, we have already, by the end of March, we have already consumed half of that. So the forecast for the remainder of 2020 for the 9 months, April to December, is around £220 million. If I were to give you a bit of color in terms of what's behind that, obviously, one of the key components is that we are demobilizing expansion works significantly, and we are negotiating some of the contracts down, and therefore we expect around £50 million of investment to demobilize or exit some of those programs. The remainder, we expect around £60 million related with asset replacement and critical safety interventions, that obviously making sure that the airport is ready to ramp back up rapidly is an absolute priority. And then the remainder, £80 million or so, are this ring fence to complete programs that are on flight, like, for example, the transition of our corporate services and some of our digital programs that we believe that those should continue. So hopefully that gives you some sense of what's to come.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Jenny Ping at Citi. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. Just one follow-up from me, please. To Javier, you mentioned earlier that we shouldn't really expect any trigger or breach of covenants, and in the main body of the presentation, you talked about interest coverage ratio becoming sort of more on the edge. Can you talk to us a little bit in terms of what you're assuming in those ratio statements about the recovery of traffic for the rest of the year? And I presume, like all the other airports and debt covenants, you have two tests in the year one, normally around June, July time, one at year end. And are your statements applicable to presumably first, but also to the one at full year? Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. So, absolutely right in terms of, obviously, we are living unprecedented times in terms of volatility, and it's very difficult to measure our traffic forecast for the months to come. That's the reason why today we are not providing outlook for the remainder of the year, and we are taking a few weeks more to really interrogate that traffic forecast and to see what happens in the start of May. So obviously the view that we have today is that we will see recovery in the months to come, but obviously if that recovery were postponed, that would put further pressure in our interest cover ratio, and obviously we will look at potential remedies if that were the case. So today we are not prepared to give you further outlook for the year to come, but that will come together with our investor report that we are accelerating rather than bringing at the end of June. We are working to provide you a more detailed outlook in early June, where we will share with you what's our forecast ratio for 2020.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Alessandro Lestalia of BlackRock. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for taking my questions. I have three, actually. One is, again, on your operating costs. So my understanding is, again, you're saying you're going to reduce your OPEX by $300 million at least. What is your assumption in terms of traffic or level of activity for the rest of the year? Because I would expect that part of this number would be dependent on actual volumes of traffic you're going to see on the rest of the year. So, I mean, another way to ask this question is, assuming that there is no recovery in traffic, how low can you push your operating cost cuts? My second question is on, it's actually more of a curiosity, but it's interesting to see that in the presentation you're saying that in March your revenues were down 29%. Your aviation traffic the same month was down 52%. So what explains the let's say, better resilience of revenues versus traffic? I understand this is clear. I mean, we're talking about accruals over here, not of cash revenues. So I'm not entirely sure I understand why is that. Finally, in the presentation, you mentioned more than once the point that you like to see a more suitable regulation. So I was just wondering if you can maybe share with us what are, let's say, the main features of a better regulation for you. If you see, for instance, mechanisms to limit or reduce traffic risk substantially, or if you think that there is a risk that the traffic rebasing coming with the new regulatory cycle wouldn't work in a scenario where traffic remains at significantly lower levels than we saw historically. That's it for me. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for those great questions. Maybe if I can take the first one and then Javi, you can pick up the second two. So in terms of the first one, as yet, we have not taken a view about structurally reducing our capacity. So when I talk about our cost base being relatively fixed in the short term, so for relatively and for changes in volume, typically over a few months period, you won't see a material variation in our cost base. The changes tend to come when you make a structural change to adapt to a different level of operating cost. Different level of demand. So, in terms of our cost base, about a third of it in total is related to people costs, and a lot of this is around frontline roles. So typically security, engineering, things like that. We have about 5,000 people working in that area. We've not made any reductions to the headcount there as yet. But if we were to take a view over the coming months that we were going to see a structural reduction in demand, then that would be an area where we would make a structural reduction in our cost base. That could be quite a significant reduction. However, it could also limit our ability to grow back again. So we need to be quite thoughtful about what the right time would be, if at all, to take that kind of step, and think about how we could build in flexibility so that if we did reduce our frontline capacity, we could adapt quickly to any significant change in demand. So it's too early to be specific about any of that. We may be able to tell you more when we do the update in June, but it's exactly the, one of the big operational issues we are discussing at the moment. Javier, do you want to pick up the other two questions?
Yes. So thank you, Alessandro. I think your second question was around revenues in March in isolation. You are absolutely right. So one of the things I did mention is during this year, in 2020, we were expecting to offer airlines a commercial airline rebate as part of the deal we signed 18 months ago. So during the months of January, February, and March, we were accruing those rebates that at the end of March and looking at the forward-looking traffic forecast, we have written off. So that has created a one-off revenue in March of 20 million pounds. So obviously the airline deal
had a couple of thresholds, and one of them, primarily the key one, is that if traffic were falling below 74.5 million in year, that airline rebate will not be payable. And that's why we have seen that one-off in 2020, which obviously, if you take out those 20 million pounds of one-off revenue, you will be left with something that is much more in line with what probably you would expect. The third question about regulation, I think that John covered briefly, and actually when you look at the long-term value generation at Heathrow and the long-term return on equity, for example, since Heathrow was privatized in 2006 and during the last few regulatory periods, clearly demonstrates that regulation is intended to regulate a much more de-risking asset. So obviously the regulator uses a model CAPM, and that even theoretically that construct is designed to a much more stable business. We have seen cyclically from the global financial crisis in 2008, the ash cloud in 2010, and now COVID, that regulation is clearly broken, is clearly not fit for purpose, and therefore we are constructively engaging with the CAA to find alternatives. Because obviously, in the context of the lack of capacity in the long term of the UK, one of the duties for the regulation is to ensure that the CAA duty over finance and creates an attractive investment that at this stage is not there for equity. So we are constructively engaging with the CAA to find alternatives to ensure that the CAA creates a long-term incentive for equity in the benefit of consumers. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And our final question comes from the line of Michael Posnansky at M&G Investments. Please go ahead, your line is open.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the question. Just quickly, if I could just be certain, what in the sort of coming months or April and May, when passenger numbers are so low, could you just outline what revenues are coming in under your existing agreements? I know there's possibly uncertainty there, but with virtually no passengers, just what revenues have you got coming into the business? And then also, given the seasonality of the business, with the summer being sort of particularly key, I was wondering if you could sort of just talk through the flexibility that you have with the interest cover ratio with that regard as this progresses sort of on a month-by-month basis.
Great. Harry, why didn't you pick both of those up?
Great. So obviously the Michael, great to listen to you. So obviously the revenue in absence of traffic would be very very limited. So we are forecasting very limited revenue, and we will give you full details as part of our investor report. So obviously some of the underlying key question that obviously all of you are trying to get your hands around today is what's our view of recovery during the summer, and that's why we are taking a bit more time to really put a stress test our forecast for the year to come. Obviously, the million-dollar question here, the trillion-dollar question is when the recovery is going to start, and this is why we are taking a bit more time to really look at that. Obviously, the recovery is going to be important not only for revenue generation, but also for interest cover ratio. The view that we have as of today is that that recovery would mean that we are not forecasting as of now a breach, but obviously if the recovery were taking longer, that could build a significant pressure. And that's why we are taking a bit more time. And in our investor report in early June, we will give you full details as well as completing the assessment of potential remedies if the recovery were taking longer.
Great. And just on that, I think I talked earlier about some of the key measures that need to be in place for us to take a view on our recovery around infection rates coming down and then making progress on this common international standard. And I think over the coming weeks, we'll get a better view on those two things to get a sense for what that means for market demand. Because as you will know, the range of scenarios is enormous, even at this stage. Great. And Harry, on the other question?
I think that was it, isn't it? Or there was another question, Michael, sorry.
I think wasn't there a question about which revenues we'd still be getting?
So I think very, very little. So I think that obviously 60% of our revenues come from our article. Some of that comes from cargo. So John mentioned that the charges that we generate from movements is very limited because our structure is designed to charge per passenger. So roughly we generate around £1,500 per cargo movement. So I think that obviously we will have some revenue, but the revenue in absence of traffic in April will be quite limited.
And there are property revenues that that do come through in any circumstance, as long as the tenant is able to pay.
Exactly.
So we're keeping a very close eye on that, and I think actually the level of payment is very good at the moment.
Okay. Well,
great.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the efforts.
Michael, thank you.
Michael.
And I should just close by thanking you all for your support. Some really, really good questions. And we will keep close to you over the coming weeks and give you an update in the first half of June so that we're sharing our latest thinking with you. I've normally talked about the great opportunities and thank you for support around future growth opportunities. This is a time when I need to thank you for your support when things are challenging. We are doing everything we can to protect your interests, and I'm confident that we'll be able to successfully lead Heathrow through what is the biggest crisis in aviation, but also not just so we protect this business, but we protect all the other parts of the economy who rely on international aviation. So thank you for that, and I hope that we will be able to meet face-to-face once again before too long. Take care.
This now concludes the conference. Thank you all very much for attending. You may now disconnect your lines.